The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 8. Dancing in the Storm. Severus couldn't keep staving Dumbledore off forever. The man was growing weaker every day, even if his mind was razor sharp. He was also, Severus knew, in quite a lot of pain. They went for a walk through the grounds of the castle. Winter had been extremely cold this year, so they walked while the sun was still up, even if starting to set, rather than at night, which Severus thought would have been more fitting. "I realize it is a difficult thing that I am asking," said Dumbledore. "Depends upon the person. I know plenty who would find the task very simple. Bellatrix Lestrange, Remus J. Lupin, Sirius Black, probably."
"Yes, you seem reluctant."
"It is, as you said, a lot. Asking a man to become a murderer."
"But you must see, Severus. It wouldn't be without reason. It will save the wizarding world a terrible blow.
And it will leave you in a good position to continue your mission."
"Ah, yes, my mission. I know you only see him as the son of your enemy, but I know Harry."
Dumbledore stopped to take a breath. He fatigued quickly these days.
"He will come when the time is right. He will come. He is honorable and brave."
There was only the sound of birds as they fed on the little creatures that came with the night. Severus thought that he had never been this silent in his life.
"You must guide him, my friend," Dumbledore went on. "He will know of the Horcruxes by now. But you must guide him to the end."
Some days Severus thought he could kill Dumbledore right then. But he stopped. He always stopped. Avada Kedavra was a curse too quick and too easy. It was the curse that took Lily's life. He could not.
"And you are confident that he will?"
Severus mumbled to cover for his distraction.
"He trusts me," Dumbledore said simply. "He is brave. He will understand that it has to be done."
And Severus used to think that James Potter was arrogant. What could he call this? This awful, rotten certainty. This assuredness that Harry would walk to his death because Dumbledore said so. This... Oh, how right had Severus been. And how blind.
"You knew. Even before the snake, you knew, didn't you? You said it was for his protection. But when you left him with that family, you knew he would grow up suffering, and he would love you all the more when he came to Hogwarts. The first wizard he ever met. The first person to treat him kindly."
The venom Severus put in the word "first" would be enough to dissolve rock.
"It is not... I did not plan for him to suffer, Severus. I do care for the boy,"
Dumbledore said in the tone which one would respond to someone who was being silly and overdramatic.
"I had to make an effort not to grow too attached to him, believe me. But he has a difficult life ahead of him, and it was better if he grew up removed from the wizarding world, and later he learned to trust me to be his guide.
His guide to the gallows.
To defeat Voldemort. By dying.
Come now, Severus." And how dismissive Dumbledore sounded. Even in his agony, he could afford that Gryffindor arrogance, that pride that said that he knew better than Severus the Death Eater, Severus the traitor, Severus the naive young boy who put his trust and love in the wrong person. Dumbledore knew better than him.
"You know I wish there was any other way, and you of all people should understand. Sometimes it is necessary to sacrifice the individual for the sake of the group. You're a spy. You face difficult choices every day."
"Yes," answered Severus simply. "But I pride myself in stopping those choices from coming."
"That you do."
Dumbledore stopped again to take a breath. He looked at the stars that were shyly starting to come to the sky, the world becoming blue and gray. His next words had the taste of honesty in them.
"Some choices, however, become unavoidable. My dear Severus, how I wish it weren't so."
They should head back to the castle. Nights were still cold. But they both remained where they were, in the gentle slopes that led down to the lake.
But he didn't grow up with the Dursleys, Severus said oh so carefully, to leave his voice free of any intonation. He was taken.
Yes.
Severus wavered. He wanted to know, he wanted to ask more.
I deeply regret the harm that befell poor Remus, Dumbledore said, and Severus closed his eyes. I never thought they would actually send him to Azkaban. He thought he was doing the right thing, I have no doubt, but it couldn't be. He was doing more wrong than right. For the sacrifice Harry must make, he has to remain an orphan. If he had parents, they would try to stop him, and Voldemort would succeed.
The way he spoke, Dumbledore left no doubts at how horrible that future would be.
Or they wouldn't be able to stop him, because Harry's generous and brave. I have no doubt that once he knows and understands, he will act accordingly, and they would have to see... In either case, they would see him die. It's unavoidable. Harry will die, one way or another. Better that it be saving the world, then. For neither can live while the other survives. I don't know if you got to hear that part, Severus.
Merlin, but Dumbledore was cruel.
I just want to prevent that pain, Dumbledore went on. Harry's sacrifice is a hard one, but it is worse to demand a father that he lay down his child's life.
True. So true. Better for Harry to grow up with people who wouldn't care if he lived or died.
So you see, he had to be taken away for Remus's sake, if nothing else. And in the end, Harry still learned to trust me, so it all worked out.
But Remus suffered, Severus said, and instantly regretted it. He shouldn't have said anything. He certainly shouldn't have called him Remus instead of Lupin. Although he is not Harry's father, he added quickly to cover his blunder.
No, of course not. But he thinks himself to be one. If only I had been able to intervene sooner, I could have prevented it.
How dismissive. Oh, he couldn't. Caution be damned. Remus was the cautious one, anyway. Severus was paranoid and had murderous instincts.
Actually, I find that he took on more of a mother's role. More nurturing.
Pardon. Enjoy this moment, Severus Snape. It is not often that you get to see Albus Dumbledore puzzled.
Remus, he said, carefully enunciating the words. He said the name like caramel over coffee and milk. He said the name with respect and devotion. He put light on the word.
More of a maternal role. A father, on the other hand, is a rather stern and distant figure. Or so I am told by the ladies from the Committee for Witches' Advancement. Did you think that Harry would grow up without both?
Was it Gryffindor courage or cowardice
that Dumbledore stared at him and said nothing?
Severus. Ah, there you had it.
Fret not, Albus. I am not going to kill you. This time Severus spoke as if he had ice in his tongue. I'm going to sit by and watch you die. You don't deserve a hero's death. You took an innocent boy and put him in a bad home. Twice. Twice, Albus. All because you thought his death was the best option, the easiest option. All because his death was easier than finding an alternative. All because you know no one can love you on their own. So you had to fake the feeling, build it with his suffering.
Severus stopped. He had started so calm and smooth, so cold, but he had grown angrier. Dumbledore was staring at him, his eyes sparkling and color coming to his cheeks. But only that. A bit of red that could be anger or could be shame. No words to defend himself.
No more words. You are going to die, Albus, but I am not going to kill you.
Severus relished those words. He relished the glimmer of fear he saw in Dumbledore's ice-blue eyes. Just as blue as, what was his name? It was long ago, he had forgotten.
the handsome DADA teacher who tried to kill that other child. Severus should have known then. But Severus the traitor, Severus the Death Eater, wasn't a cruel man. All he had done in his life, his rights and his wrongs, he had done for love. He spoke again. I am not without mercy. I will not put your mind at ease, Albus. Voldemort will fall, and Harry will live. I am Slytherin. We can always find a third option. He turned around to leave. Dumbledore could find his own way back to the castle, or he could walk into the lake and drown for all Severus cared. He turned again, however. After fewer than 10 steps, Severus was close to Lucius Malfoy, who was easily insulted and terribly vindictive. He knew how stupidly spiteful people could be. He spoke over his shoulder, smooth, sweet, like too sweet cocoa powder. Oh, and remember, as you yourself said, you need me in a good position to protect everybody. Try anything against me, against Remus, Sirius, anyone else, and I will tell Minerva of your plan. See what she thinks of Harry going to the Dursleys to suit your interests. Percy was so incredibly tired that when he came home he couldn't even undress. He couldn't walk to his bed to fall asleep. He couldn't even cry. Helga Hufflepuff had been right. His was a heavy burden. But you don't get 12 owls for nothing. Percy, his brothers used to say, was the odd Weasley who should have been in Ravenclaw and ended up in Gryffindor instead. Bill had 12 owls too, but Bill was effortlessly brilliant. He didn't count. However, Percy was no Ravenclaw. He was more like a Hufflepuff, really. Percy was organized, and he was driven. Percy had 3 different alibis prepared, and his living room ready to accept an overnight guest, even though he hadn't had to bring anyone yet. Percy allotted himself 10 minutes a day to break down and cry, and if he couldn't do it then, because often he was too tired for tears, then he would have to wait until the next day, because there was too much to do, and those were the rules he had set for himself. He rarely got more than 2 days of warning, 2.5 at the most, which is why in the meantime he prepared for every eventuality and had dozens of excuses ready. Twice already he had saved his father's life without deviating from his carefully constructed routine. And how could such a boring and meek man get into so much trouble for Merlin's sake, openly speaking for Muggles and Muggleborns and even standing up to freaking Eustachius Avery Sr.? But even if the saving itself was simple enough, Percy had to think beforehand and have a plan ready, and that took so much energy, really. No wonder Percy was tired. This time the vision came with 3.5 days of warning, at lunchtime on a Tuesday, which gave him a blissfully free weekend to work with. And it was still too little time, too little. It would happen in between the late night and early morning of Sunday to Monday. It would be discovered an hour after sunrise. They would move before noon. He was in his office. He was at work. He had to keep cool, Percy, chill. He also had to warn his mother because, of course, the burrow was bursting at the seams with people and they couldn't just go. They needed somewhere else to hide. They needed time to find and prepare a second safe house. And so were the twins and Sirius and Remus, but theirs was a different case. The burrow first. They had to empty it and they had to hide. And many other people whose future Percy couldn't see, but Percy didn't have to be a seer to know that they would have to run. Silence in the burrow was such an odd thing that the ghoul in the attic came downstairs to see what was going on. Molly Weasley sat in her armchair, the old green and yellow thing with a burn mark for when Charlie was 5, the armchair in which she knitted and drank tea. She was white. Molly was not a person faint of heart, but she was white and she was scared. Most of the members of the Order were there, not the ones from Hogwarts, but pretty much everyone else. They had been debating Galahad's latest message, telling them of a raid come Monday, telling them to leave, abandon the house completely. The thing was, how could they trust him? Nobody knew who it was. Galahad was just a name that had proven helpful in the past. That was not enough to dismantle their center of operations. The note had come in a big cream-colored envelope. In fact, the note was written inside the envelope, which they had to unfold to see. Inside the envelope itself, there had been a second one, this time lilac. They had argued who Galahad was and whether this message came from him at all. He had been active for months now, and Moody suspected he was a spy because he seriously doubted anyone's ability to remain undiscovered this long. Or at the very least, the real Galahad had been found and killed, and now a ministry spy was taking his place, trying to uncover the identities of the Order members. Shacklebolt thought they couldn't afford not to listen. Ezekiel Smith started to speak, dropped two frongs from his mouth, and then scribbled that he also suspected the message. When Duncus Fletcher said the opinion of people who got themselves cursed and were still vomiting frongs shouldn't even count, Smith tried to answer and dropped three more frongs that somehow managed to convey his message. The last one, big and fat, knocked over a vase before jumping out the window. This was around the time Molly opened the lilac envelope and all color fled from her face, and she had to sit down.
"Ezekiel Smith drops a frog that knocks over Muriel's vase," she read.
Everybody shut up at that. Everybody. Arthur, who had just arrived from work and still had his jacket on, went to Molly to hold her hand.
"A prophet."
Shacklebolt was the first to break the silence. He had nerves of steel, that man. It was good having him there.
"Or something very much like that. Could he have charmed the paper so it would show us something that recently happened in the room?" Moody thought aloud more than asked. "We can't just trust him because of a parlor trick."
"Jeez, Moody, why'd overthink it?" called Tonks from the armchair that had become hers. More often than not lately, she had been sporting light brown hair down to her shoulders, and nobody knew if it was her natural hair or if she was just feeling down. She was still healing, and even if she was adamant to keep fighting, she looked pale and weak, like a little bird in winter.
"What I would like to know is why this gentleman doesn't come forwards to us," mused Alphaeus Doge.
He was not a bad man, was Doge. But he liked Dumbledore too much, and he was irritatingly pompous.
"I think we might have to heed this warning, regardless of who Galahad is and what motivates him." Shacklebolt spoke with such command that it was reassuring, even when he admitted that things were about to go bad. He always sounded as if he had an idea of what exactly went wrong and therefore knew how to make it right.
"After all, the note only speaks of an attack in this house. It's not like it is telling us to go somewhere specific. We should at least consider moving certain people."
"Kingsley, don't you dare look at me," Tonks said quickly. There was a faint shine of red in her hair.
"We have discussed this before. You have not been cleared for combat by the Mediwizards."
Fletcher snickered and then jumped at Tonks's jinx. She was weak and ill and still working on regaining the blood she lost, but none of these was an obstacle for casting a curse, especially if she was sitting.
"Maybe just for Monday," offered Arthur, who knew very well that his wife would fight leaving her house tooth and nail. "I just wish we knew why this man was doing this," whispered Daedalus Diggle, nursing a mug of chamomile tea in his hands.
Nobody liked following the advice of a mysterious stranger, and yet every small tip so far had been useful. And yet, as Moody pointed out, that is how you gain someone's trust, so you can later betray them and have them all slaughtered. You give a little bit first before taking a lot. And there was a third envelope in Molly's lap.
"Why don't you open it, Molly?" asked sweet Emmeline Vance.
A very powerful witch, mind you, but still so sweet and caring. People tended to argue less when she was in the room, and the power of her spell work was only half the reason for it. Molly was still pale, and her lips were pressed in a tight line, but her fingers didn't tremble as she carefully unfolded the green paper.
"Something very much like that, Mr. Shacklebolt. I don't know if that kind of charm is possible, but I am sure the twins would have the answer. I commend your dedication to skepticism in any case, Mr. Moody. A number of issues. We have common enemies and common goals, but we differ in the method, Mr. Doge. Miss Tonks, please listen to the man. And may I suggest escorting your muggle father somewhere safe? No, not just for Monday, until the end of the war, Mr. Weasley. I'm sorry to say so. And why do I not let you be murdered by Rabat and Lestrange? I wanted that myself, Diggle. I'll be done with the questions. Good. If you don't evacuate the house, you'll be murdered by Death Eaters, and I will be most displeased. Don't make me come get you. I really don't have the time to spare."
"You all heard it," Shacklebolt said.
Again, his restraints took over the room and stopped the shock and the tears before they could even start.
"Let's get to work."
"Thank you, Mr. Shacklebolt. You really are a joy to work with."
"Creature, come here," Harry called. "Try this and tell me what you think. More salt." The elf went. He hated when they cooked in the kitchen, but he still went to Harry's call and took the offered spoon of stew. He was, like the house, like that boggart that left, defeated and conquered.
Certainly not, master.
No? Harry was surprised. I would have thought a bit more.
Master Draco prefers less salt and more cumin, master.
Harry laughed. Oh, creature, are you playing favorites? He asked in mock anger. I didn't know your heart had room for anyone other than Regulus.
Master is very well regarded by creature,
the poor elf said instantly. Harry noticed, of course, that in these conversations they had in the kitchen day after day, the mistress was never featured. The elf worried about what the mistress would say, what she would think of the house and her descendants, but he didn't love her, not one bit. What a fascinating thing was a house elf psyche. Harry understood them now just as little as on the first day. He had simply become better at holding a conversation with them, mostly because they were small and often abused, and Harry couldn't be anything but kind to small and often abused creatures. He added a little bit more of salt, because damn Draco. But he also got the cumin down and sprinkled it over the lentil soup because, well, damn Draco. I guess Regulus and Draco are pretty similar, Harry said while he stirred the soup. Pure-blood Slytherin, supposed to follow Voldemort and to make the families proud. I saw a photograph the other day. It seems like Regulus was a seeker. So Draco and I, but yes, similar those two. Only Draco got out in time and Regulus didn't and paid for it, poor man. Poor child, killed by other Death Eaters is what Sirius had said. Not a fortnight after Draco's christening. And Draco had been just like him. What a horrible thought. Harry shook himself and took another spoonful. Okay, try now, creature, better? The elf tried the stew again, nodded, and then he started to speak. Oh my god, you guys! Harry exclaimed as he burst into the library. His eyes were still a bit red from crying because, wow, way to be blindsided with the story. Poor, poor creature, and poor Regulus, too. He had to go retrieve his body. Not now, because he had other things to do first, but it was going in his to-do list. You're not going to believe what I just—
Hurry!
Called Hermione. Her brows were doing that thing that meant bad news. She and Draco had been practicing their spell work with their new wands, but the pillows and cups they used for targets were now abandoned, scattered around the room, and they were both bending over the paper.
What?
Harry demanded. What could be more important than his news? Now that he thought about it, what could be so important that it merited a special edition of The Prophet?
Dumbledore is dead, said Draco.
He sounded hollow, like he did when there was a crisis and he was pushing down his emotions for later, trying to keep a cool head to think and getting somewhere in the vicinity of a glacial.
Okay, yours is bigger.
Dumbledore's death was so important, so full of consequences, that the death itself became irrelevant. What was important was this new Dumbledore-less reality, not how he died. They said he had died of old age. They said that the Master Potioner in Hogwarts had poisoned him slowly. It didn't matter, in any case. But if you must know, he didn't have an easy death. Not the worst, either. He got exactly the death that he deserved. The irony didn't escape either of them. In fact, the irony vexed them. Because neither Lord de Moustier, Secretaire de la Magie, nor Hermann Ingersleben, Bundeskanzler of the Magie Ministerium, were willing to speak in their homologue's native tongue. So, of course, they used English as a convenient neutral language, and the English were the bastards that made this mess in the first place.
Shit, said the Secretaire, her head in the fireplace. Indeed, answered the Bundeskanzler. We are close to them, you know.
Close to receive refugees or close for invasion, either would be a problem, although she knew damn well which one she preferred.
Yes, but you said it yourself. He's not very liked in La France, so it won't be such a problem, Ingersleben pointed out. Germany is another thing. Two ministers came already to cry in my office. In Germany we have beautiful mountains, the best flying brooms, and plenty of nut jobs that love a man flashing with power. You can't control a nut job. Idiots have no government.
Ingersleben knew things were bad when de Moustier didn't immediately reply that French brooms were better. Thickness was still the visible head of the British government, but as soon as they learned of Dumbledore's death, they had dropped all pretense. They were only going after Muggleborns at the moment, but Ingersleben was sure that within 2 months, the half-bloods would be in trouble too, and the purebloods eventually, because at the end of the day, it's us against them. And they would move the line so that you would become one of them.
Shit, said Hermann Ingersleben.
That was the feeling. There were people who cheered in Italy and people who locked themselves in their houses to cry. There were old women, women who remembered, women with white hair and black clothes and hunched backs, coming to their doorsteps and painting a mark in the lintel, the secret mark from long ago that told the Metizio that this was a safe place. Spain stopped fighting for a moment. "Hay que joderse," said every group, or some variation thereof, before resuming the fight. To date, they hadn't been able to send a representative to speak with Dick Ness because they kept fighting each other, not just with the other groups, but inside the Voldemort sympathizers. At this point, they had something close to 5 governments, 2 of which had declared independence and were printing their own money. For the most part, however, Dumbledore's death and Voldemort's immediate switch to open war wasn't felt too much on the continent. The British had forgotten about the rest of the world, and as long as Voldemort kept hunting down British muggles, well, it was their business to deal with. One shouldn't go intervening in other people's countries, especially when said countries are close to your own, and you are not exactly prepared for war. But it was felt in Ireland, oh, how it was felt. Not proper wizards were they, even the purebloods, they were just not as good. But they would show them, oh yes, they would show them their place. That Monday, 6 Death Eaters appeared in the burrow. They found the place empty, left by an uncanny silence. Everyone was gone, and not a single living creature remained there. Even the attic ghoul and the gnomes in the garden had left. They burned it down. A house that had been so full of life and laughter, a house with the marks of happy children living there. The fire erased Charlie's burn in the armchair and the 100 little accidents from the twins and the scratches in the floor from Bill's boots. In the wall below the stairs, the fire erased the pencil marks of the children growing. The year when Ron finally became taller than the twins circled and underlined. The summer when Percy suddenly became just as tall as Bill. That other summer, not so long ago, when they added an 8th name to the wall, and they kept it there on successive visits, usually close to Ginny's. They burned down everything, took everything, every single thing touched and used and loved by the Weasley family, every memory. But that's all the Death Eaters managed to take that day. They also went to Weasley's Wizard Wheezes. That area of Diagon Alley was soon deserted as people were too afraid to even stand in the street outside. They watched from the windows, and the lunch crowd in La Maison Blanche looked through the glass while pretending not to be doing so. They saw 3 figures at the joke shop, 3 figures dressed with dark robes but with the hoods down. It doesn't get worse than that when your murderer comes with their face uncovered. They didn't know who the other 2 were, but the one in the front, that was Antonín Dolohov, the torturer. The one the goblins called Iron Whip. Everybody knew him. Everybody knew that cruel face with the long black hair slicked back and the pointy beard. His eyes were like the end point of a dagger, and it felt as if just his gaze could cause pain. He had a purple mark, like a half moon under his left eye. That mark was new, but no one dared think that it might be a scar. They saw, from behind curtains and glass, the 3 men entering the joke shop with its bright front. Just 3 weeks ago, the twins had put up the You Know Poo poster, and everybody had had a chuckle, despite themselves. A scared laugh, but a laugh nonetheless. Even if they kill you, sometimes if you can laugh at your enemy, you are killing them too, their image and their memory forever tarnished. This was a hollow comfort when everyone knew what those men had come to do. They saw them enter, and after just a minute they saw a flash of bright green light reflected on the storefront glass, the purple and blue and yellow of the packaging and the posters in the window all muted by that bright, sick green. And then there was white and electric blue and almost a dozen red flashes in quick succession. The glass at the front cracked, and some of the posters caught on fire. They waited in silence. Nobody dared say a word, not a gasp of horror, because what if people were listening? What if someone thought it was wrong of you to show horror or compassion for those 2 boys being murdered? What if you were next? After approximately 10 minutes, they saw the twins come out of the shop. One of them, wearing a yellow sweater, doused the flames and prepared the glass. The other, green sweater, levitated 2 bodies out of the shop, knocking them in the head as they went to the floor. All things considered, Dolohov wasn't too bad. He was just passed out, and his robes and hair were smoking a little bit, and he was bleeding, but probably nothing life-threatening. The green sweater-wearing twin deposited him on the ground in the middle of the street, and then he put the significantly bigger and heavier second Death Eater on top. It was impossible to identify him, given the nasty furunculus hex he had gotten in the face. He looked like a man made out of porridge. Green Sweater went back inside while his brother finished fixing the shop and closing down, planks on the door and shop fronts and everything. Then Green Sweater returned carrying two suitcases and a turtle shoved under his arm. He put the suitcases down before depositing the live turtle, its legs were moving, on top of the small Death Eater pile. He also had three wands, which were promptly snapped. There was a gasp at this. By then Yellow Sweater was finished. He had put a sign on the barred front of the shop that read, "Gone into hiding due to murder attempt. We'll reopen after the war." They waved goodbye to the few faces that were only now daring to take a peek from the windows. They made a bow for their audience, and taking each other's arms, they apparated away. "Good job," said Remus as the twins appeared in the flat upstairs. The twins beamed and straightened. Praise from Remus felt like getting 50 points each for their house. Not that points mattered, though. Like a gold sticker, then. That said, Remus turned his attention back to the windows and the illusion fog he was casting. From the outside, it would look as if the building were abandoned and had, at the most, a colony of pigeons living in it. Sirius was casting Muffliato everywhere, and there were another couple of wards Remus wanted to set before they called it a day. Look, everybody had seen them go. Nobody would expect them to stay in the shop. That was crazy. Remus had ample experience in safeguarding a house, a werewolf house, and this way, they didn't have to figure out how to take with them the sofa and the beds and all the stuff they had in the storeroom. Plus, if it weren't going to work, Galahad would have told them so. Galahad had sent two more warning notes to the burrow during the weekend. They knew because the twins were helping their parents move. "Finnegan, I need you to come on a date with me to Hogsmeade." Seamus Finnegan had stared absolutely befuddled as Blaise Zabini, current secretary of the Student Union and Interhouse Solidarity Party, made his request. "Do not be confused," Savini had said. "I don't have any romantic interest in you whatsoever." "Then was I need to get rid of the competition. Thomas is coming dangerously close to a Weasley. Once he sees me with you, he will become jealous and abandon his pursuit." Seamus had stared some more. "Okay, are we talking about Ron or Ginny here? Don't be dense, Finnegan. Of course it's Ginny. I will come get you at 5, and I will treat you to dinner. Dress to impress, please." "Okay," Seamus had answered, even though he hadn't said he agreed yet. He had thought the whole thing was hilarious. Zabini smiled smugly as he took Seamus's chair for him, and Dean spent his whole date with Ginny, throwing them increasingly flabbergasted and slightly horrified looks. Ginny also thought it was amusing, but less so after 15 minutes of Dean not paying any attention to her. It had been so funny. When Zabini took Seamus's hand, Dean had dropped his pumpkin juice all over himself. It had been so funny. And then it wasn't. At the end of the course, they didn't know what was going to happen to the half-bloods, but everybody had heard they were already arresting Muggleborns. They didn't know if it was true, but they couldn't afford to believe it was a lie. "Gotta run, mate. Take care." That's all Seamus had. 5 words scribbled on the back of Dean's ticket for the Hogwarts Express. Dean and a few others had decided at the last minute not to take the train back home. They didn't want to bring the hunt to their families, their Muggle families that couldn't defend themselves. They abandoned robes and trunks at the station and left with whatever they could carry. Dean had taken a minute to send this message to Seamus through a pureblood first year. The ones that didn't go with them ended up regretting it and jumping from the train as it came to the station. There had been aurors, wasn't the word for it, it felt wrong to use it, but yes, there had been some aurors waiting for them at the platform. Neville Longbottom had his lip and nose broken, but he managed to keep them busy enough that when they reached the last carriage, all those who had jumped were already out of sight. So yes, the thought of making Dean jealous was less amusing after that. Ron and Ginny didn't return to the burrow at the end of the course. They couldn't. There was nothing to return to, and no parents to meet them. Instead, they were greeted at the train station by a stone-faced Percy and a Bill doing his best to be composed and not look worried. Percy was very well situated in the ministry nowadays, and Bill was good enough at his work that the goblin showed an interest in his continuing existence between the living. Because of them and because of their pureblood status, they would not be harmed. They were still children, after all. They had nothing to fear. "William will be taking care of you," Percy said. As if William were some new adjunct in the office instead of Bill, their brother Bill, the one who always took care of them. I'm far too busy to look after children.
Children. Ginny was so angered that she tried to curse him right then and there.
Slugginess Aruktiger!
Percy had stopped the curse before Ginny was done speaking. Even Bill was impressed, or at the very least surprised. Everybody knew Percy was a good wizard because he had excellent grades, but that was just theory. It was hard to see him as someone who could perform neat magic. Percy was so uncool you couldn't imagine him doing anything remotely competent. Percy just looked extremely bored and only mildly annoyed. He adjusted his glasses with his left hand, fingers delicately surrounding the frame. He was also the only Weasley kid to need glasses.
As I said, I don't have time for childish antics. I do hope you won't bring any trouble to your brother. This family has plenty of that already, he sighed, as if his family were nothing but an annoyance. I did try to warn you about the kind of company you kept. William.
Percy nodded his head to his eldest brother and left, not even a glance back at the three of them.
You know, Percy is right. Calm down, Jenny. He is right. We are not in a secure position. Fred and George had to go into hiding, did you know? Sent 3 Death Eaters after them. Who knows what they would do to you?
If Bill said something was serious, then it really was. Bill was fun, but he was also a professional curse-breaker, so he knew to recognize and respect danger. That was the very first requirement of the profession. As much as curse-breakers seemed cool and fearless, they did not joke around with their work. So Bill knew very well that the Death Eaters were waiting for any excuse to kill each and every one of the blood traitors. He took them to the apartment he was sharing with Fleur, just as flatmates, they had said at first. They were both looking for a place to live in London, and it made sense to split the bills. But really nobody believed the second bedroom had seen any use at all, ever. Ginny would be staying there while Ron would take the sofa. They didn't have any more space. It was one of the worst nights in Ginny's life, and she had been possessed by Voldemort when she was 11 years old. Ginny was strong and fiery and bright. But when she went to bed that night, she felt terribly lonely and small and worried sick. And she missed her mother no matter how much she fought with her. She hated that place. She hated seeing that pretentious bitch who had her claws on her brother, hers, her Bill, who taught her how to defend herself and fight back when the twins' teasing became too much. She hated that strange Ben. She hated Percy. She hated Ron for being silent, and she hated Bill for being right. And most of all, she hated herself for not being strong enough, powerful enough to fix this, to get her family and her world back. She hated that she was crying, and she hated that Ron came into the stupid strange bedroom and sat next to her and held her in his arms without saying a word. Stupid Ron, who was always too overprotective. Percy had taken up yoga. Because his life wasn't complicated enough, he had gone and signed himself up at a Muggle gym and took classes 3 times a week. He had developed a resistance to the most common calming potions and sleeping potions and headache potions, any sort of useful potion, really, and he was in much need of calm, sleep, and a pain-free head, hence yoga and meditation. It was surprisingly good. His sleep had not improved, but he was dealing with the stress and anxiety better. Now he didn't cry at all during his daily allotted time for breakdowns, so he had added 5 minutes and used the time for meditating instead. Percy hadn't lied, he was really busy. His family was safe, all of them for the foreseeable future. They were fine, but there were many others that were not fine, and what was worse, were not going to be fine. Percy knew this, Percy saw this, and many times Percy could do nothing. Percy was just a flimsy young wizard, not even 21 years old yet, who still didn't know how to keep his curls in place if he didn't drown them in gel. He could not bring down a tyrannical regime single-handedly, and he could certainly not save every single person he met. Percy was smart. He knew that. Doesn't mean it didn't hurt. Seeing someone's future and knowing this time he could do nothing. The worst were the cases where he could do something, when he knew he could save them. But saving them meant condemning himself and often dying. So many times now had he seen his death. And if Percy died, he would not be there to protect his family. He would not be there to stop that cursed prophecy that still haunted his dream. The worst cases were the ones when he was selfish and he chose himself. He chose to live to later save his family and thus condemned someone else. He was becoming so good at yoga, he could loop and bind his arms around his thigh now. The Muggleborns were identified and arrested, their wands taken. They were brought to trial for the crime of stealing a wand and supplanting a proper pureblood wizard, although who that pureblood wizard was, whose place they had taken, they wouldn't say. They were starting to identify the half-bloods, too. And then,
Even without a wand, you could do magic. Everybody knew that. That's how every child started. Thea was a Muggleborn, and estranged from her brother because she had been absolutely insufferable during her teenage years when she was going to Hogwarts, while David went to Muggle High School. She looked at the cell, where they kept her and another two Muggleborn wizards, and tried to remember what David, who she was missing so much, she tried to remember what David, the structural engineer, said about materials and support and forces in the few family dinners they still had. She tried to remember, and she focused on a weak spot in the ceiling, and maybe, all of them together, maybe they could manage to bring it down and get out of there. And maybe they would. Let's say they did. Let's say that everybody survived. The Muggleborns and the Muggles who dared marrying wizards and witches, and those same wizards and witches who went and sullied their bloodline mixing with Muggles and the half-bloods they produced. Let's say all of them survived, and everybody was fine. Let's leave it here and not say another word. Some say that the ones who struggled and fought back, the ones who were killed, they were the lucky ones. Perhaps this was true. Death has a horrible finality, but there is also compassion in it. Death brings the end of everything, and sometimes that is good. The ones who didn't die, some of them were sent to Azkaban. Were they the lucky ones? They didn't die, even if they walked and sat with death now. Undead, unalive. If hope were something that could be felt in Azkaban, they could hope for the end of the war and the triumph of Harry Potter, the child who left, or the wild children of Hogwarts, or anyone. They could hope to be rescued someday and brought back to the world and to life with just a tenth of the madness that fell over Bellatrix Lestrange and Sirius Black. But they didn't. They didn't feel anything other than despair, unending and eternal. They couldn't even hope for their own deaths and the end of this misery. The others, they were not sent to Azkaban, and no one had any idea of where they were. Were they the lucky ones for avoiding Azkaban? Some said they had been stripped of wands and clothes, that they had been chained and made to serve the new lords as punishment for their crimes. They could hope to escape, but that was a very small hope for such a large amount of pain. And then there were the ones who escaped arrest. The ones like Dean that slipped through the cracks and made a run for it, but there was nowhere to go. Even if you made it off the island, to France or somewhere else, there was nothing for you there, no friends or family, and just the goodwill of strangers to help you go by. They were lucky, yes, but they didn't have it good. The lucky ones were, in fact, the Muggleborns. Even if they were the first targeted, the Muggleborns had the advantage of knowledge. They knew how to buy tickets for a normal train or bus. They knew how to blend in. They knew how to pass for a proper Muggle, and they were not killing all Muggles, not yet. So it was safe amongst them. It was a matter of keeping cool and feigning they couldn't see the Dementor coming down the street straight at them. Keep calm, and if you don't look at them, the monsters will leave you alone for now. Then there was her, the woman who couldn't see Dementors, but if she could, she would have no problem ignoring them. This was a woman with nerves of stainless steel, who would not let a rag stuck in a vacuum cleaner spook her. Ever since Harry's passing and then Remus's, Teresa kept on the stove a pot half full of water. She had, like any proper British person, a water boiler to prepare tea. But now she also had the water on the stove. When the men came, she turned the stove on and told herself this was just quirky but perfectly acceptable behavior on her part, using the pot instead of a proper teapot. Haha, not paranoid at all. When they drew their wands on her, she had half a pot of boiling water to throw to the face of the closest one. Not enough to stop them, she knew that, but enough to buy time and make noise. Someone had noticed, apparently. Someone in the ministry had noticed that she used to be married to a wizard, and that she lived 13 minutes away from Lupin's cottage, and they had thought this was an interesting fact worthy of further investigation. This shouldn't have to be a problem except for when they had noticed. Except for how the ministry was taken by Death Eaters, and how there was a purge going on, and if there was even the faintest possibility that she knew something about Harry Potter, they would investigate it. The man screamed high and raw when the water hit him, obviously unaccustomed to pain. She hit the second one on his extended arm with the pot, and bought herself a few seconds.
Go!
She yelled.
Go away!
Big words, important words. She had angered those men just to get the time to scream those words. They would think they were directed at them. They were not. Teresa knew there was no way she would survive this. She had been doubtful for the first few minutes, not knowing what kind of wizards these men were. Men that were big and broad and had cruel eyes. But then she had gotten their measure, and she knew they were the kind that not only thought Muggles were idiots, most of them seemed to think that, but that they should be killed or enslaved. They would torture and kill her, whether she gave them the information they sought or not. The fact that she had known Harry was completely irrelevant. Had they come an hour earlier or so, Teresa would have excused herself to bring them tea and fled through the kitchen window. But she couldn't do that now. She couldn't leave the house with them inside. She had to stay, and she had to make enough noise to give a warning, to let her know, please, don't come inside. And there was a spell, something like an electric shock hitting her on the chest, and she came down to her knees, her muscles twitching with spasms. Her fingers had suddenly no strength, and her hands opened uselessly. She cried. They would think it was the pain, but what did they know? They didn't know the house. They didn't know of the air draft and the way the curtains moved every time someone opened the front door. They didn't know, despite their own history, that a mother would do anything to protect their child. She would let them hurt her, cut her, beat her, rape her. She would let them do anything, if it meant that Olivia didn't cross that door. If it meant that she turned around and ran, please, please, just like in the football games, just run. Olivia wasn't a witch, even though her father was a wizard. She could not do magic, and she had not received a letter of acceptance from Hogwarts. She could not do what most people would call magic. Harry Potter and Professor Estabang from Sukatana University thought differently, though. There is magic in the world, beyond what you can do with a wand. There are powerful spells in simple acts. There is a subtle power that moves the world, and just because you don't call it magic, it doesn't mean it is not. There was a very short distance between the door and the kitchen, short but not so short that Olivia couldn't get enough momentum. This was the Muggle magic. This was her channeling the heroes of her generation. This was Olivia calling for the strength of Zidane and Ronaldo and Van Basten and Figo, too, even if he was a double-crosser. This was Olivia, who was all thighs and hips and still warmed up from her football training session, running down the hall of her house to land a 1,000-pound force kick on Nicholas Maltzeber. Enough to break bone and ligament in the knee and send him to the floor in tears. And then, because unfortunately there can be some really ungentlemanly behavior in football matches to which our younger generations are exposed through television and mass media, and since these cubbish acts come from their idols, they are taken as role models. Then Olivia turns to the second Death Eater, the one who is still complaining about having his face boiled, and she headbutted him so hard she sent him to the floor. He hit his head on the kitchen counter as he went down, and did not move anymore. Olivia screamed. It was a wonderful scream, close to a roar. Teresa mopped the spilled water and the blood, and thought very carefully about whether or not she should take her child and go into hiding.
"Oh, yes, please," said Olivia. "Let's."
"Children that go into hiding are still required to study," Olivia groaned. Teresa decided against it for now, but she instructed her daughter to prepare 2 overnight bags, one to keep in the car, and one to hide somewhere else outside in case they had to leave without notice and couldn't go back home to get their things. If that happened, they would have a toothbrush and clean underwear and an extra pair of socks. Olivia did all that while Teresa drove away with the men in the back of her car. Olivia shouldn't have to see or even know of this part. Teresa didn't even let her help drag the men to the car, although they were both quite heavy, and the fat one was not helping things with his struggling. But the other wasn't moving, and Teresa didn't want Olivia to see that. She dropped them off a bridge 2 hours away from home, and because they had threatened her daughter, Teresa made sure they would not return later to stir more trouble. She had gone through their pockets, and she had seen the papers, the order to find and kill Harry Potter. She knew him as Fleamont, but it was all the same. And Remus Lupin and Sirius Black and Ted Tonks and Arthur Weasley and Diana Diggle. She had seen the line over the name Hermes Mansarius and the silver ring, too small for any of their fingers, with an inscription inside that said Love, M. Well, no more. She made sure of that. No more. The wand she snapped and chucked in a rubbish bin, but she kept the ring, made a note to keep it somewhere safe. One day she would return it. She called her son. gave him an edited version of what had happened, and told him to be ready. She instructed Olivia on how to act and what to say, and when they came, because someone would come to see if they were dead and find out what had happened to those men, that was for sure. When they came, Teresa and Olivia gave a very good impression of having been obliviated.
I know you, don't I? I'm sorry. I don't know. I've been very forgetful lately. I'm full of bruises, and I can't for my life remember how I got them.
Teresa extended her arms, although she was wearing a long shirt, and thus any bruises that could be there remained covered. She smiled faintly.
Of course, John! Of course I know you, John. Are you here for a date? We used to date, and then we got married, I remember now.
Meanwhile, Olivia barely glanced at her father before shrugging and going to the living room to turn the telly on. Ignoring him was no hard task, given how little they had seen each other. He never paid any alimony, barely came to visit the year when they were divorcing, and never once the process was finalized. He had stopped writing once Olivia turned 11, and he rejected Eddie, which to Olivia was the biggest sin anyone could commit. She would rather have punched him, but ignoring him was good enough, given the circumstances. Teresa thought John might have suspected something, but he said nothing, and he told his partner that since the Muggles had been obliviated, it meant Mulciber and Rosier had left, and obviously thought they shouldn't do anything else to the two women. Whatever happens to them, it happened somewhere else. Case closed. Let's go. It was not enough to redeem him, not at all, but it was enough to let Teresa and her children off the hook. And when he went back to the ministry, he made sure to misfile the documents of the case. Neither side, Severus thought. Neither side was prepared for victory. On the one hand, they had let Peter Pettigrew live when he ought to have had his skull bashed in with a rock and his remains burned in acid. Severus knew how. But they let him live so that he could go to trial, and so he escaped. They were not ruthless enough, and mercy rarely wins anything. Look at Dolohov. They let him live, the Muggles, although barely, and the ministry wizards that arrested him back when Scrimgeour was still kicking around, they let him live, fools as they were. And so Dolohov was able to try again, this time against the notorious fools, Fred and George Weasley. They let him live, the twins did. They and their secret guests, only Severus and someone codenamed Galahad knew about. They let him live, and Severus thought it was folly. He was giving back his assets to Voldemort again and again, but Voldemort wasn't prepared to win either. Voldemort did them the service of killing Dolohov himself, and Gideon and Jugson. Rosier he didn't kill, but he disappeared together with Mulciber while on a mission investigating the whereabouts of Harry Potter, and were yet to be found. Rumor said they had discovered something that made them desert, and that they were punished for it. McNair was alive, because McNair was a disgusting, sick person, and he was quick to blame the Muggle fiasco of little whinging on Dolohov. He was a hard one to kill, that one, Severus knew, because of that incident with Lily in her sixth year. And this was how it went. Just during the first few months of the Second Wizarding War. Although one could say it was not the beginning. The war had started long ago. End of chapter 8. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.